Chapter 52. Clayton Findlay did indeed prove to be a godsend. While Hollis briefed his men inside an unused warehouse, Pitt, Gunn, and Giardino helped Findlay sculpt a diorama of Santa Ynez Island from mud scooped beside the airport's runway on an old ping-pong table. He refreshed his memory of what he'd forgotten from Pitt's nautical chart. He hardened the miniature landscape with a portable heater and highlighted the features with cans of spray paint scrounged by one of Hollis's men. Gray for the rocky terrain, white for the snow and ice of the glacier. He even molded a scale model of the Lady Flamborough and set it at the foot of the glacier. At last he stood back and admired his handiwork. "That," he said confidently, "is Santa Ynez." Hollis interrupted his briefing and gathered his men around the table. Everyone stared at the diorama in thoughtful silence for a few moments. The island was shaped like the centerpiece of a jigsaw puzzle produced by a drunken cutter. The ragged shoreline was a nightmare of spurs and hooks, gashed by barbed fjords and gnarled bays. It backed on the Straits of Magellan to the east and faced the Pacific Ocean to the west. It was dead ground, not fit for a graveyard, 65 kilometers wide by 95 kilometers in length, and peaked by Mount Wharton, 1,320 meters high. Beaches and flat ground were virtually non-existent. The low-lying mountains rose like rock-bound ships, their steep slopes falling in forlorn agony to meet the cold sea. The ancient glacier sat like a saddle on the island. It was the result of cold and overcast summers that did not melt the ice. Barren escarpments of solid rock flanked the frigid mass, standing in sullen silence as the glacier gouged its irresistible passage toward the water, where it calved section after section the way a butcher slices sausage. Few areas of the world were more hostile to man. The entire island chain of the Magellans was uninhabited by permanent settlers. Through the centuries, men had come and gone, leaving behind wrathful names like Breakneck Peninsula, Deceit Island, Calamity Bay, Desolation Isle, and Port Famine. It was a hard place. The only vegetation that survived was stunted, twisted evergreens that merged with a kind of scrubby heath. Findlay swept a hand over the model. "Imagine a barren landscape with snow at the higher altitudes, and you pretty much get a picture of the real thing." Hollis nodded. "Thank you, Mr. Findlay. We're much obliged." "Glad to help." "All right, let's get down to the hard facts. Major Dillinger will lead the airdrop force while I'll be in command of the dive team." Hollis paused briefly to scan the faces of his men. They were lean, hard, purposeful-looking men dressed entirely in black. They were a tough breed of fighters who had survived torturous survival training to earn the distinction of serving with the elite Special Operations Force. A hell of a team, Hollis thought proudly to himself, the best in the world. "We've trained long and hard for ship seizures at night," he continued, "but none where we've given away so many advantages to the enemy. We lack critical intelligence information, the weather conditions are miserable, and we're faced with a glacier that can shatter at any minute. Perplexing problems, tough problems that stand in the way of success. Before we launch our assault in a few hours, we want as many answers as possible. If you see a grave flaw in the operation, sing out. So let's begin." "Island inhabitants?" Dillinger asked Findlay straight away.
"None after we closed the mine."
"Weather conditions?"
"Rains almost constantly. It's one of the most heavily watered regions on the continent. You rarely see the sun. Temperatures this time of year run a few degrees below freezing. Winds are constant and can get violent at times. The wind chill factor is a bitch, and it's almost certain to be raining."
Dillinger gave Hollis a grave look. "We don't stand a prayer of a pinpoint airdrop at night." Hollis appeared grim. "We'll have to go in with the minicopters and scale down with ropes."
"You brought helicopters?" asked Gunn incredulously. "I didn't think they had the speed and range
to fly this far so fast," Hollis finished. "Their military designation has too many letters and digits to memorize. We call them carrier pigeons. Small, compact, they carry a pilot in an enclosed cockpit and two men on the outside. Comes equipped with an infrared dome and silenced tail rotors. They can be broken down or assembled in 15 minutes. One of our C-140s can transport six of them."
"You have another problem," said Pitt.
"Go ahead."
"The Lady Flamborough's navigation radar can be tuned for aircraft. Your carrier pigeons may have low profiles, but they can be read on a screen in time for the hijackers to prepare a nasty reception party.
So much for surprise from the air, said Dillinger morosely.
Hollis looked at Findlay. Any adverse conditions we should know about for an assault from the fjord? Findlay smiled faintly.
You should have an easier time than the Major. You'll enjoy the advantage of frost smoke.
Frost smoke?
Fog-like clouds formed from the contact of cold air with warmer water near the glacial wall. It can rise anywhere from 2 to 10 meters. Combined with the certain rain, your dive team should be cloaked from the time they begin their approach until they climb onto the decks.
One of us gets a bit of luck after all, said Dillinger. Hollis rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
We're not dealing with a textbook operation here. It could turn real messy if the airdrop is a foul-up. All surprise would be lost, and without it, the 20-man dive team isn't strong enough to engage 40 armed hijackers without support. Since it's suicidal for your men to parachute onto the ship, said Pitt, why not drop them farther up the glacier? From there, they can make their way to the edge and then rappel down ropes onto the main deck.
We'd be looking at an easy descent, agreed Dillinger. The ice wall is above the ship's superstructure and near enough for us to clear the gap.
Hollis nodded and said, The thought crossed my mind. Anyone see an obstacle with this tactic?
Your biggest danger, as I see it, said Gunn, is the glacier itself. It can have an endless labyrinth of crevasses and treacherous snow crusts that give way under a man's weight. You'll have to take it slow and damned careful crossing it in the dark.
Any other comment?
There was none.
Hollis gave a side glance to Dillinger. How much time will you require from airdrop to attack readiness?
It would help if I knew wind velocity and direction.
9 days out of 10 it blows from the southeast, answered Findlay. Average velocity is about 10 kilometers an hour, but it can easily gust to 100.
Dillinger stared pensively for a few moments at the small mountains rising behind the glacier. He tried to visualize the scene at night, sense the severity of the wind. He ticked off the time inside his head. Then he looked up.
40 to 45 minutes from airdrop to ship assault.
Pardon me for telling you your job, Major, said Pitt, but you're cutting it too thin.
Findlay nodded. I agree. I've hiked the glacier on many occasions. The ice ridges make it slow going.
In a smooth, greased movement, Dillinger pulled a long, wicked-looking bowie knife, angled between hilt and blade, from a sheath behind his back and used the spiked tip as a pointer.
The way I see it, we'll make our jump on the back side of the mountain to the right of the glacier. This should hide our C-140 transport from the ship's radar. Using the prevailing winds, which hopefully will run true to pattern, we'll glide our stealth parachutes around the mountain for 7 kilometers, landing within 1 kilometer of the glacier's forward wall. Time from jump until we regroup on the ice, I'd judge 18 minutes. Time to walk to glacier's edge, another 20 minutes. 6 more minutes to prepare rappel operation. Total time, 45 minutes.
I'd double it if I were you, said Giordino disapprovingly. You'll have a hell of a time meeting a deadline if some of your men fall in a crevasse. The dive team won't be aware of the delay. Hollis shot Al a look he usually reserved for war protesters.
This isn't World War I, Mr. Giordino. We don't have to synchronize watches before we go over the top. Each man is custom fitted with a miniaturized radio receiver in his ear and a microphone inside his ski mask. No matter whether Major Dillinger and his team are late or mine is early, so long as we are in constant communication, we can coordinate a joint assault.
One other thing, Pitt broke in. I assume your weapons are silenced.
They are, Hollis assured him. Why?
One burst from an unsilenced machine gun could bring down the wall of the glacier.
I can't speak for the hijackers.
Then you'd better kill them quick, muttered Giordino.
We don't train to take terrorists as prisoners, Hollis said with a cold, ominous grin.
Now then, if our visitors can restrain their criticisms, are there any questions?
Dive team leader Richard Benning raised his hand.
Sir?
Benning?
Will we be approaching the ship underwater or on the surface?
Hollis simply used a ballpoint pen as a pointer. He tapped it on a small island in the fjord that was behind a point of land and out of sight from the ship.
Our team will be ferried by pigeon carrier to this island. Distance to the Lady Flamborough is about 3 kilometers. The water is too cold for a swim that far, so we'll stay dry and move in by rubber boats. If Mr. Findlay is correct about the frost smoke, we should be able to approach without detection.
If it's dissipated, we'll enter the water 200 meters away and dive until we reach the hull. A lot of balls will be iced if we have to wait very long for Major Dillinger's team to get in place. A small wave of laughter echoed from the 80 men gathered around the diorama. Hollis sighed and gave a broad smile. I don't intend to freeze mine. We'll give the Major an ample head start.
Gunn raised his hand.
Yes, Mr. Gunn, Hollis said wearily. What's on your mind now? Did I forget something?
Just curiosity, Colonel. How will you know if the hijackers somehow get wind of the assault and lay a trap?
One of our aircraft is filled with advanced electronic surveillance equipment. It will fly a circular pattern 7 miles above the Lady Flamborough, detecting any radio transmissions sent by the hijackers to their collaborators outside the region. They'd scream like madmen if they thought a special operations force was closing the net around them. The communications men and translators can intercept all transmissions and alert us in plenty of time.
Pitt made a casual motion with one hand.
Yes, Mr. Pitt. I hope you haven't forgotten the Numa party. Hollis lifted an eyebrow. No, I haven't forgotten. He turned to the geologist. Mr. Findlay, where did you say the old abandoned mine was located?
I neglected to place it, replied Findlay, matter-of-factly. But since you're interested...
He paused and placed a match cover on the side of a small mount overlooking the glacier and the fjord.
She sits here, about 2.5 kilometers from the forward edge of the glacier and the ship.
Hollis turned to Pitt. That's where you'll be. You can serve as an observation post.
Some observation post, grumbled Giordino. In the dark and rain and sleet, we'd be lucky to see our own shoelaces.
Cozy and safe and out of harm's way, Pitt said pontifically. We may light a fire in the stove and have ourselves a picnic.
You do that, Hollis said with some satisfaction. He looked around at the assembled men.
Well, gentlemen, I won't bore you with a gung-ho pep talk. Let's just do our jobs and save some lives.
And win just one for the Gipper, Giordino muttered.
What did you say?
Hal was saying what an honor it was to be part of an elite fighting force, said Pitt.
Hollis gave Giordino a stare that would cut glass. Special operations forces do not give out honorary memberships. You civilians will stay back out of the way.
Hollis turned to Dillinger.
If any of these Numa people attempt to set foot on the ship before I give permission, shoot them. That's an order.
A pleasure, Dillinger grinned sharkishly.
Giordino shrugged.
They certainly know how to vent wrath around here.
Pitt did not share Giordino's caustic mood. He understood perfectly Hollis's position. His men were professional, a team. He gazed around at them, big, quiet men, ranged in a rough circle around the model. None was over 25. As he stared into their faces, he couldn't help wondering which ones were going to die in a few short hours.